It is Tuesday, March 29th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, U.S. federal investigators appear to win a victory in a battle against consumer electronics giant Apple. But did they also hurt themselves in the process? I'll ask VOA's cybersecurity expert. What's motivating the Islamic State militant group to strike Western targets such as Brussels? The author of the book ISIS Inside the Army of Terror will tell us, and why is the Swedish superstar DJ Avicii retiring at the age of 26? We'll have the answers to that and more on International Edition. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, says it has found a way to access the data on an Apple iPhone using an undisclosed method developed by an outside source whom they have not identified. The development ends a legal fight between the U.S. government and Apple in the case involving the phone used by Syed Farouk, the Islamist militant behind last year's attacks in San Bernardino, California. Apple had resisted the FBI's efforts to use legal means to force it to unlock Farouk's iPhone. Doug Bernard is VOA's cybersecurity correspondent. I asked him what he found to be the most significant thing about the FBI cracking into the iPhone without Apple's help.
I think what's interesting is what Apple's response is going to be. You can bet that if indeed the FBI was able, through a third party, to break into that phone, they say they have. We have yet to see the actual results. But you can bet that the Apple engineers are going to be poring over that to figure out how it was done. I think it very likely that they probably will patch whatever vulnerability was exposed. But also, and Tim Cook has said this, I think, almost explicitly, the next iteration, the next iOS operating system, you can darn well expect that the encryption is going to be beefed up, as well as other probably new security functions.
But how is Apple going to create the necessary patches if the government doesn't tell them how they broke into the phone?
Well, every company, especially companies like Apple, which has a very kind of closed system, they're always working to try and hack their own products. So I think just the fact that they heard, well, perhaps maybe it was an Israeli cybersecurity company that was able to defeat this auto-erase function, they're going to redouble their efforts.
So they'll have to do some of their own detective work, basically.
Oh, absolutely. And that's very common. People are always trying to crack their own products because they know if they don't and fix it, someone else will.
Well, you know, the FBI had been pursuing a legal case against Apple that could have set a precedent favorable to the government in granting a legal permission to break into phones. Now the government won't get such a legal precedent because it dropped the case. So does that hurt the government in any way?
Well, it won't get that precedent for the moment. I think it's very likely that the FBI and Apple as well will continue to look for the best test cases for their arguments. It's very possible, by the way, that the way this trial was going, and of course it would have been appealed, but, you know, it's possible the FBI thought, well, we thought we had a strong case, but maybe we didn't have the strongest case here. And the last thing you want if you're the FBI is a weak precedent, you know, really establishing the groundwork in a new legal area. So both sides, I think, are going to continue to look for the best case that makes their best argument.
Well, in terms of Apple, you know, they didn't want to give the FBI a backdoor.
Right.
And then the FBI just went ahead and found someone else who could create that backdoor for them. So Apple doesn't know what method the FBI used and whether the government will use the same method again for other phones. So do you think Apple, to an extent, hurt itself by creating this situation?
Well, I think that, you know, it's very possible that the FBI actually may have hurt itself because, remember, all through this whole proceeding, they've been arguing, we can't do it, nobody else can do it, we have to have Apple engineers help us.
It turned out to be not the case.
That's what it appears at this point. So, in a way, that weakens the FBI's argument. I think Apple's argument case may have been weakened as well, but look, for the moment. But again, I think what we're going to see is both sides not backing down, and Apple's really just going to double down on making encryption and personal security key selling points of its products.
Well, thank you very much to our cybersecurity correspondent, Doug Bernard.
Great to be here.
Let's turn to our social media segment with International Edition's G.I.B. Lee, who's with me in the studio. Hey, G.
Hi, Michael. Well,
what is the trending hashtag for this story?
It's Apple versus FBI, spelled Apple vs. FBI. Now, on Facebook, NPR was one of the first media outlets to post a story about it. It wrote, "It took FBI investigators about a week to test a third-party tool and successfully crack the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone passcode." That post generated more than 1,100 comments.
Wow. Can you read us some of them?
Sure. So the one with the most number of likes, a whopping 3,000 likes, reads like this. "You mean to say they had the power all along, and yet for some reason, they wanted to change the laws regarding privacy. The second most liked comment is this. "Good, it gives the FBI what they needed without setting a dangerous precedent. Apple will now change their encryption and make it even harder to break, as they do constantly anyway."
So it seems like a lot of people are relieved that there won't be a need to change U.S. privacy laws. Is that right?
That's right. That is a popular sentiment, although some people are more understanding of the FBI's initial request for cooperation from Apple. Now, speaking of privacy, NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden had a lot to say as well. He's on Twitter, @Snowden, and describes himself like this. "I used to work for the government. Now I work for the public, director at Freedom of Press." Snowden sent a number of tweets about the incident, and one of them reads like this. "If I were Apple CEO Tim Cook, the next Apple keynote speech would send a message that even the FBI won't have trouble decrypting. iPhone works for you and you alone." More than 1,500 people retweeted that. Michael?
As an iPhone doesn't work for the government, right?
I know.
Well, thanks very much, G. You can find G on Twitter at GAbbyLee. And you can also find the show on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A thunderstorm overtakes an airport, a terrifying experience for someone who's afraid to fly. But this situation's not real, it's just playing out on a smartphone inside of a virtual reality headset for a patient with phobias.
For me, everything was stressful. Before flying was stressful, it was stressful to go to the airport. The takeoff was stressful.
But that was before Gerardo Gary started treatment in Argentina with psychiatrists from the Poder Volar organization in Buenos Aires. And Gerardo says he's now cured of his fear of flying. Psychiatrist Claudio Pla.
Virtual reality is wonderful for therapists because it allows us to recreate the feared scenario in an office.
The psychiatrist can control the intensity of the feared virtual experience, but they say the treatment must be used in combination with real experience for phobia patients to improve. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Belgian authorities said Tuesday they've revised the number of people killed in last week's attacks on Brussels airport and a metro station down to 32. The Brussels attacks, which were claimed by the Islamic State militant group, were the focus of this week's hashtag VOA TV program hosted by my colleague Mil Arcega. He spoke via Skype to Hassan Hassan, co-author of the book ISIS Inside the Army of Terror. Hassan also is a resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, a Washington think tank. Arcega asked Hassan why the Islamic State group recently has been targeting Western cities like Brussels.
For ISIS, you know, these attacks are a target, a very narrow audience. It wants to appeal to this audience. Look, in the region, in Iraq and Syria, these attacks are being criticized. They alienate people more from ISIS. They don't accept this organization. But when ISIS carries out these attacks, it wants to target a specific audience, like I said. They want to kind of appeal to people who are already, kind of extremists, people who revolve in the orbit of either Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other radical groups. And it wants to appeal to these people because it knows that these people are more resilient, more committed potential recruits than ordinary people who don't. Accept these things, who want to live in a democracy, want to live in freedom and so on.
Right.
So ISIS wants to first to appeal to this audience, But also for ISIS, it's a battle of resilience. It wants to say to the world that it's still there and it's still capable of carrying out attacks.
Hassan, very quickly, did you have any inkling when you and Michael Weiss wrote your book, Inside the Army of Terror, did you have any inkling, any idea how large a global threat ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call them, would become?
I think so. I mean, in terms of rhetoric, from the beginning, I remember just as I was preparing, like drafting the book or writing the book, I traveled to Turkey, and in southern Turkey, in Urfa, near the Kurdish areas in Syria, I met a person who works for ISIS as a security official, a person who is responsible in charge of having spies, of having a smuggling network in Turkey and neighboring countries, in his case, just in Turkey. You know, he wasn't like, he didn't wear a beard. He was, you know, clean shaved and so on. But he was speaking about how the lesson that ISIS learned from the Iraq war is that not to be on the receiving side, the side of attacks. It shouldn't stand by and wait for the West to plot attacks against it and eliminate it, as the Americans did in Iraq in 2006 when it worked with tribes in Iraq to uproot the organization, and they did so successfully. So ISIS learned the lesson, and when it moved to Syria and became the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, it had that in mind, that mindset. Now, it's important to understand that ISIS is still young as an international organization. It was born only in 2013 as the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Before that, it used to be the Islamic State of Iraq, and before that, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So it was more of an Iraqi organization. So it was only 3 years ago that they established itself as an organization that operated in Iraq and Syria, and only 2 years, even less than 2 years, as a caliphate or as a self-styled caliphate. So this international network of ISIS is evolving, and it's becoming more dangerous by the day, and which requires people to be more prepared and be ahead of ISIS as it evolves.
And that was Hassan Hassan, co-author of the book ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. You can hear more of that conversation by watching the full show online. You can find that show at voanews.com/#VOA. Authorities in Pakistan have detained more than 200 suspected Islamist militants in a major crackdown triggered by Sunday's suicide bombing in Lahore. That attack killed at least 72 people, many of them Christians, celebrating Easter in a crowded public park in the capital of the country's most populous province of Punjab. Correspondent Ayaz Ghul, who's based in the Pakistani capital Islamabad, spoke to International Edition today about the Pakistani Taliban breakaway faction that claimed responsibility for the attack in Lahore.
Jamaat-ul-Ahrar was previously one of the founding members of this Pakistani Taliban, which is a coalition of dozens of extremist groups in Pakistan who started their anti-state activities back in 2007, basically in response to Pakistan's operations in the tribal areas where extremist groups have long resided or have had their bases. So when those operations started, these groups, which are in the tribal areas located there, primarily focusing on the insurgency in neighboring Afghanistan. But then when Pakistan Army started their operations, they changed their focus, and some of these groups came back from Afghanistan and started their operations inside Pakistan. And that's when they decided to call themselves or created this group, so-called alliance of the Pakistani militant groups called the Pakistani Taliban. But then at one stage, there were certain factions within this extremist alliance who tried to negotiate with the government of Pakistan because of the pressure of the military operations to really give up violence. And that is when some of the group's hardcore militants decided to part ways. And Jamaat-ul-Ahrar was one of those groups which decided not to negotiate and continue with their extremist activities. And Pakistani authorities now are saying, or have been saying for the past few months, that the leadership of this group is residing in border areas of Afghanistan, and from there they are directing these terrorist attacks and suicide bombings inside Pakistan.
And that was correspondent Ayaz Ghul speaking to us from Islamabad. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Nature is sending us messages all the time, but most of us can't read them. One exception is British explorer Tristan Gooley, who's led expeditions on five continents. As Faiza El-Masri tells us in his new book, The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs, Gooley shares more than 850 different clues from nature that can help people find their way, predict the weather, and get more out of their time outdoors. Faith Lapidus narrates.
If you're in the middle of the wilderness with no compass, no map, no worries. Author Tristan Gooley says you can still find your way home if you're able to figure out which way is north.
One of the first things to look for is the sun, if it's out. But if we're north of the tropics, then the sun is due south in the middle of the day. So that's the best place to start.
Trees can also be helpful because their shape and color can indicate compass directions.
Trees grow bigger, more bushy. There's just more tree on the southern side because that's the side they get most of the light. And also their leaves are smaller and lighter in color on the south side than the north side. They have sun leaves on the south side and shade leaves on the north side.
Nature also provides clues that can help predict the weather.
Well, I think a lot of people are still familiar with the most popular bits of weather lore. So red sky at night, sailor's delight. There's a lot of truth in that because our weather comes from the west. We know the sun sets in the western part of the sky. So if we see a red sky at night, what that's really saying to us is that the atmosphere is clear to the west. It's clear in the direction our weather is coming from.
Gooley says there's nothing new about reading nature's signs, but today people tend to ignore them. He points to the sky as an example.
But there are lots and lots of clues that people knew 100 years ago that we've started to forget. So each cloud is actually trying to tell us something about what's going on out there. A really nice example is if we see a halo around the sun, that's telling us there's a certain type of cloud, a cloud known as cirrus stratus up there. And that's one of the clouds that we see just before bad weather approaches. So it doesn't mean bad weather's definitely coming, but it's a strong clue to be observant and look for some of the other ones.
You can scan the horizon for more clues. No matter how clear the sky is, Gooley points out, the horizon is never blue. There's always a white hue.
A lot of people don't notice that. You know, a lot of people go through their whole lives and they don't notice that. It's because of something called Rayleigh scattering, which is the way light scatters as it travels through. And once we start to spot a few effects like that, it can actually help us so make predictions.
Pure white along the horizon signals the air is clean. When it's off white, this is a clue that there are impurities in the air. When the color is gray, it means the air contains dust, soot, salt, or acid droplets. Tristan Gooley has compiled his wayfinding advice in his newest book, The Lost Art of Reading Nature's Signs. He says with the arrival of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, this might be a good time to be more observant, try to pick up on cues and clues, and read nature's open book that is all around us. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Fans of electronic dance music have reacted with shock to the news that Swedish DJ Avicii is retiring at the age of 26. International Edition's David Byrd is here to tell us what's behind Avicii's surprise decision. So wake me up when it's all over, when I'm wiser and I'm older. All this time I was finding myself enough.
Didn't know I was lost. Best known for his 2014 smash hit Wake Me Up, Avicii, born Tim Berling in Sweden, said that this would be his last year on the road. In a lengthy letter posted on his Facebook page, the 26-year-old told fans that a recent trip across the United States with some friends helped him to see things in a new way. He said the trip helped him realize it was time to step away from touring. Avicii has been plagued with health problems starting in January of 2012, when he was hospitalized for 11 days with acute pancreatitis reportedly brought on by heavy drinking. The condition flared again in 2013, and he had to cancel several live shows and was hospitalized again in Australia. In 2014, Avicii was forced to cancel a series of performances in Miami because of illness and had to have surgery to remove a burst appendix and his gallbladder. The Swedish-born DJ told the Associated Press that the time he had to take off from touring helped him realize that a life change was needed.
Went to the studio and I did that, and I was like 20 kilos thinner, and I was like, I looked like a skeleton and like still jumping into the studio, you know. But then I kind of realized that I just had to take some time and just focus on me and just kind of getting back in shape, getting back in like both physically and mentally, and, you know, try to set up a long-term plan for all of this, which is, I think, what we did.
Hey, brother, there's an endless road to rediscover. Hey, sister.
In his letter to fans, Avicii did not say that his health was the main reason for his retirement. He said his choices and career have never been driven by material things, but he is grateful for his success. He also spent a lot of time thanking people, especially his fans. Avicii told the AP that after taking some time off, he feels restored, even better than he felt before he started touring.
If I look back to me before I started touring, you know, I feel better now, which is weird to me. But that's all thanks to, like, exercise and to all the people around me who's like really helped me out a lot.
I'm addicted to you.
In his letter, Avicii said that he will never let go of music. He will continue to speak to my fans through it. He also hinted at a possible return, saying, I could be back, but I won't be right back. And in a unique turn, the DJ said he has a new phone and gave fans the number to text him about all this. However, he did ask fans to bear with him because I might not be super quick to reply. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A Vietnamese court convicted and sentenced Nguyen Thu Vinh and his colleague, Nguyen Thi Minh Thieu, on March 23rd, under Article 258 of the Penal Code, for allegedly abusing the rights to freedom and democracy to infringe upon the interests of the state. Nguyen Thu Vinh, also known as An Ba Sam, was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Nguyen Thi Minh Thieu was given a 3-year sentence. Both have been in custody since May 2014. Nguyen Thu Vinh, a former police officer and party member, started the blog An Ba Sam in 2007, publishing articles and commentaries on Vietnamese political, social, economic, and cultural issues. In a statement released March 23rd, the United States Embassy in Vietnam said the U.S. is deeply concerned by the Vietnamese government's conviction and the sentencing of the bloggers, noting that the use of criminal provisions by Vietnamese authorities to penalize individuals peacefully exercising their right to freedom of expression is disturbing. These convictions appear to be inconsistent with the right to freedom of expression and freedom of the press provided for in Vietnam's constitution and with Vietnam's obligations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and other international commitments. The United States calls on the government of Vietnam to release unconditionally these two individuals, as well as other prisoners of conscience, and allow all Vietnamese to express their views peacefully without fear of retribution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237.